the Mountain Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. With the inquiry hearings and today articles of impeachment announced, it may feel as if Congress has had no time to do anything else, but they have. It's a new trade deal between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, a NAFTA 2.0, if you will. We'll hear who gets to reap the benefits and which side of the aisle gets to claim the credit. Plus, a rankings list that's sure to thrill and upset Angelenos all at the same time. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Lots to get to today. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, we're going to hear from Assemblyman Chad Mays about why he left the Republican Party to become an independent. Plus, the restaurant list we've all been waiting for, the LA Times 101 Best Restaurants. We're going to hear from the critics about what made the list and why.
I think we're looking for restaurants that have a lot of creative agency, but also creative urgency.
That's coming up toward the end of the show. Stay tuned for that. But we start today with a deeper look at trade. The United States, Mexico, and Canada have struck a new deal that has both Democrats and Republicans claiming victory.
There is no question, of course, that this trade agreement is much better than NAFTA. But in terms of our work here, it is infinitely better than what was initially proposed by the administration.
That's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi there speaking at a press conference this morning. The deal is called the USMCA, and it's an update to the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, passed back in 1994. Now, naturally, it's expected to have a major effect here in California, which exported nearly $50 billion in goods to Mexico and Canada just last year. For more on what it all could mean, let's hear from Renee Bowen, professor of economics at UC San Diego. Welcome to Take Two.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. Now, this deal has been called NAFTA 2.0, so let's start with the basics. Why is this deal even needed?
Well, NAFTA, the original North American Free Trade Agreement, was signed in 1994. That's 25 years ago. So some updates are clearly needed simply because technology has evolved, businesses have evolved, and one has to take into account advances in technology, digital platforms, and changes in intellectual property that have affected the way we think about trade agreements.
Yeah, my phone updates like every other week, Renee. So yeah, this trade deal probably did need a little tweak here and there. So what are your overall impressions of it?
Overall, it's certainly a good thing. The most important thing, perhaps, about trade agreements is that it reduces uncertainty about policy related to international trade. One of the difficulties with the last phase of negotiation was, of course, the possibility that we may no longer have a trade agreement between the United States, Mexico, and Canada. That would have negatively affected folks such as farmers in California. Given that we have a new agreement with new provisions, not only are farmers protected from any downside of not having an agreement, but now new industries are actually given more freedoms under this new USMCA.
What are some of the issues it addresses?
So the new USMCA takes on more forcefully issues of intellectual property, digital trade, and of course, labor standards. Those are just three of the things that are addressed in the new agreement. In terms of intellectual property, this has been seen as a large issue for industries such as pharmaceuticals, anything having to do with and any industry touching on things that require people to ascribe value to something they've created, right?
Yeah.
So this also includes Hollywood or movies. It includes studio recordings of anything, including music. So, the intellectual property provision is going to be important for the entertainment industry. It's going to be important for the technology sector. And of course, Hollywood, Silicon Valley, they will all benefit from this.
Yeah, tech, entertainment, that's California's jam right there, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Now, House Speaker Pelosi referenced an initial proposal made by the Trump administration, said that it's infinitely better than what was initially proposed. Remind us what was originally proposed.
Right. So the new USMCA is very much like the old NAFTA agreement, but it adds some provisions, as I mentioned before, for intellectual property protection, for digital trade, but also on labor standards. And perhaps the provisions on labor standards are what is most different from other trade agreements that we've seen. But I should add that each of these provisions, these new provisions that we're seeing under the USMCA, were also discussed and included in other trade agreements, such as the Trans-Pacific Partnership that the United States had signed but decided to back out of, and that is now currently in force but without the United States. So the things that we're seeing in the new USMCA have become features of new trade agreements. The reason that this is a good thing and the reason that this is sort of an innovation in trade agreements is that we finally have an agreement where the United States is part of these new innovations.
Talking to Renee Bowen, professor of economics at UC San Diego, talking about the new trade deal to replace NAFTA. At a basic level, Renee, could more jobs be the result of this deal?
So, interestingly, the labor provisions under this new deal allow for, in the auto sector, some minimum wage in the countries that are signatories to the NAFTA agreement. So that, on the face of it, sounds good for labor. It sounds that, for one, U.S. labor will be more competitive than Mexican labor. But as, of course, many economists will tell you, one downside of imposing minimum wages is that it can reduce firms' incentive to employ. So we might actually see increased unemployment. Now, the question is, will we see that increased unemployment in the United States or Mexico? And it's most likely that Mexico will bear the brunt of that increased unemployment. And of course, that's not great for Mexico. It's also certainly not great for the Mexican auto sector that has to pay those higher wages.
I was going to ask, we mentioned how Hollywood and tech and farmers seem to win here. Negatively affected by the deal, is Mexico right now the thing that stands out the most, or the country, the place that stands out the most that could be negatively affected?
So to say that they could be negatively affected, so it's certainly constrained to the auto sector. Okay. And labor in the auto sector. The fact that we do have a new deal, the uncertainty is reduced. All of that is good for all the signatories to NAFTA, including Mexico. So yes, there may be some give and take, and the give here has been in the auto sector in Mexico, but the benefits certainly outweigh the negatives.
Now, the elephant in the trade agreement room, Renee, is the United States and China renegotiating their trade policies. Could this be a template or help move that along?
Right. Well, certainly, as I said, agreements, even going back to the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, that is now the TPP, Comprehensive Partnership for Trans-Pacific Partnership, and the new NAFTA or USMCA, all these agreements have been moving towards including things such as digital trade, increased IP enforcement, and labor protections as part of these trade agreements. So going forward, we would expect to see these in other trade agreements, such as the trade agreement that's being negotiated between the United States and China. So it's to be determined if it actually comes to force in this agreement. Of course, anything we see in the final agreement is a negotiation between the two countries, sure. But it's likely that this will be part of it.
That's Renee Bowen, professor of economics at UC San Diego, talking about the new trade deal to replace NAFTA. Renee, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. It was a busy morning for Speaker Pelosi. Just minutes before announcing the new trade deal, she and House Democrats introduced two articles of impeachment against President Trump. The first article charges him with abuse of power. The second, obstruction of Congress for blocking testimony and refusing to write documents subpoenaed by the House. It is the fourth time in U.S. history that articles have been introduced against a sitting president, and the Judiciary Committee could vote on them as early as this week. Let's get some reaction from a local lawmaker. Democrat Harley Ruda represents California's 48th congressional district based in Orange County. Congressman, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Glad to be on the show.
Now, a few publications today have reported that the Judiciary Committee could debate the articles as early as tomorrow, then vote this week. What have you heard about when the committee will recommend them to the full House of Representatives for final approval?
That's not exactly known right now, but you are correct that it appears the Judiciary Committee will be discussing the markup of the articles of impeachment tomorrow. So it could be as early as later this week that it comes to the entire floor, but that's not definitive by any stretch.
Okay. And just to be clear, you are 100% on board with all of it?
Yes, I have been participating in the hearings that we've had, as well as the depositions of most of the witnesses who participated over the last 30 days. I have found the conduct and behavior of the president extremely concerning to not just our national defense, but also to his obligations under the Constitution.
Now, Congressman, during last week's hearings, constitutional scholar Jonathan Turley said that Democrats are moving too fast on impeachment and that they should wait to build a more complete case. What do you think about his argument?
And we certainly heard that argument from the Republicans as well. I find it interesting that the Republicans were arguing before that this was taking too long, but now they're arguing that it's moving too fast. Look, here's the issue in that argument. Trying to bring on the additional witnesses are people like Mulvaney and Pompeo and Bolton, who have declined subpoenas, properly authorized subpoenas from the United States Congress, as well as in the case of Pompeo's department and Mulvaney's department, to produce documentation. They have refused to produce documents. They've refused to testify. And so we have a president of the United States who has committed a crime and has prevented those who participated and or witnessed it being able to participate. So waiting for a judge in a court to determine when they would be required to participate is difficult at best for providing the appropriate rationale for us to slow down the process.
We're talking to Democratic Congressman Harley Ruda of Orange County. Do you think that waiting a little bit longer would put the election, the upcoming election, in some kind of jeopardy?
No, I don't see that at all, and I see them mutually exclusive. The oath we all took to the Constitution requires us to uphold that oath. And here we have a president who has clearly violated his obligation to the Constitution of the United States, coupled with putting our national security at risk through his actions. So this is not about how it impacts the election. This is about what we hold our president to do or not do, and in a clear case of abuse of power.
Is there anything that suggests to you that a Senate trial will be anything but a highly partisan debate with no discourse, no defections from either side?
I do think there will be the potential for some Republicans to support one or more of the articles of impeachment. However, I do agree with your statement that once again, it will be partisan, because that's the nature of the politics we live in right now, where it's like the old Russian adage, if you tell a lie enough times, it becomes a truth. And that's certainly what President Trump and many of his supporters have followed, that that guidepost. So even Lindsey Graham, who under the Clinton impeachment said just denying and refusing to honor a subpoena is an impeachable offense, comes out and says, as head of the judiciary, that he already knows that articles of impeachment and removal from office will not happen, and he'll make sure that it doesn't happen. So we've had a complete hypocrisy by the Republican Party in what went down with the Clinton impeachment to what's transpiring now.
Because that makes me wonder, Congressman, your district, the 48th, created in 1993, five Republicans won seats until you came along and then beat Dana Rohrabacher to flip it. How has the impeachment inquiry gone over with your constituents?
The vast majority of the calls and emails we've gotten have supported the impeachment inquiry. And, you know, I got to tell you, I used to be a Republican, and I didn't come to Washington to impeach President Trump. I came here to work across the aisle and get work done. And that's exactly what we've done and what my office has done. We have passed almost 400 bills in the House of Representatives, a vast majority of them bipartisan. But unfortunately, only 18% of them have been passed by the Senate. So there are opportunities to pass good legislation, bipartisan legislation that supports our communities and our country, but we need a willing partner with Mitch McConnell.
But really quick, your district, your constituents, how have they taken all this? I mean, it's got to be not easy to hear every single day.
Be candid, there are more important issues for most people in America and in my district, whether it is talking about health care, gun violence, addressing climate change, offshore drilling. There's a host of issues that have our attention and have had us produce incredibly important legislation. So while impeachment certainly is the headlines of the day, there's a lot more important work, or equally important work, I should say, that is taking place.
That's Democratic Congressman Harley Ruta of Orange County. Congressman, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Take care.
California State Assemblyman Chad Mays of Yucca Valley had been a lifelong Republican, but the last time we spoke, he seemed to be wavering.
Today, there are two political parties in the country. There are Democrats and there are Republicans. I wish that there was a third way, but today there isn't.
Chad Mays did find that third way. He's next when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now to more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. Amy Martinez. Chad Mays, an assemblyman from the Coachella Valley, is the latest California official to leave the Republican Party. Such a move was on our minds when we spoke with him a couple of months ago as he was working to revamp what he saw as a problem with the GOP's image in the state. So now that he's made the jump and will run for re-election as an independent, we brought him back on to talk about his decision. Assemblyman Mays, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, eh?
Now, when we talked back in August, you were still holding out hope for the Republican Party, and here's what you said.
Today, there are two political parties in the country. There are Democrats and there are Republicans. I wish that there was a third way, but today there isn't. So the question is, do I continue to stay in the Republican Party to fight to try to make it better, or do you walk away? For now, and as we're talking right now, I'm going to continue to keep fighting the fight.
So, Assemblyman, what happened since then? What changed?
Almost every week, somebody would ask me, why do you still stay as a Republican? You know, what can you do to be able to change this caustic environment that we're in? And what got to me was a question of when you start to think about your service and your time, when you start to think about actually filing for re-election, what you want to accomplish and what you want to get done. And I do believe that the political discord that is in this country today is harming our democracy. It is the worst I have ever seen it. And one of the things that the tools that you have in your toolbox is just perception. You know, the labels matter. And I wish the labels didn't matter. But one way of being able to deliver a message for my next election is to say, you know what, I am done with this two-party. Republicans are as bad as Democrats. It is silly. And I know that the public is tired of the two-party system, as am I.
Is this that third way that we discussed back in August? I mean, and how do you see this as a third way when maybe now you've taken yourself out of this two-party political discourse?
You know, it's interesting. Right after I made this decision, the number of people that have reached out to me that have sent me emails saying, you know, we're so glad that you did that. I did it a month ago. I did it 3 months ago. I did it 5 months ago. I do think that there is, I will call it pent-up demand for people in this country, people in this state that are tired of the two-party system. And I think there's this hunger for something new. The question is whether that can be organized. There's no way that I can do that on my own, but I do know that based upon some of the emails, the phone calls that I've received, I know there's a lot of people that are out there that are hoping for it.
Well, that's the thing, right? You're still an assemblyman. You still have to get work done, interact with both sides. How will you do that when you're not wearing a red or blue t-shirt?
I actually think I'm going to do it better. It's felt good to me, the number of my colleagues that have reached out to say, we're so glad that you did what you did. I wish that I had the guts to be able to do that. Even amongst legislators, there's this sense that the system itself is broken and that it needs to be fixed. And they're thankful that I stepped up to actually do it.
Now, back in August, you asked Twitter a question. That is a dangerous thing to do for any question at all, Assemblyman. But your question was, what does Republican mean to you? And the internet responded pretty aggressively and pretty negatively in a lot of ways. Did that change the way you felt about being a Republican?
You know, I don't think that question itself changed. My ideology, my belief system has been consistent since the time I was in my late teens till today. My experiences have changed. I do think that the political environment that we're in today have changed. I think the parties have changed, and I think the parties are no longer representing people. The parties are now representing themselves.
We're talking to California State Assemblyman Chad Mays, formerly a Republican, now an independent. The impeachment inquiry of President Donald Trump has been underway for more than a couple of months now. How has that influenced you?
You know, watching some of the discourse this morning by some of the members of Congress, how angry that people are in committee as they're debating this. It's amazing to watch Republicans defend the indefensible. And it's also amazing to watch Democrats attack when sometimes maybe their attacks aren't warranted. And it's that attack, counterattack that is the problem. We are Americans. People say that politics is a blood sport. Well, in reality, politics isn't a sport at all. The chief end of politics is how do we come up with policies that are going to make people's lives better? And that's all lives in this country and in this state. We've lost sight of that. We need to get back to that.
Now, you sought the Republican Party's endorsement in October, and now just before the deadline to register for re-election, you switched. You went independent. Why'd you wait?
It's interesting. The CAGOP sent out an email saying that I begged for their endorsement. Actually, I got a phone call from them saying, hey, we're doing endorsements. If you want our endorsement, you need to send an email in. So I shot off a quick little email. You know, I hadn't come to any conclusions yet, but hey, it'd be great to be able to have your endorsement. So it's interesting how even that was the narrative that was told. But it's when you sit down and you knew I sold my house and I needed to actually change, actually physically change my registration because of the location. And when you do that, you're like, well, I guess this is a moment which I'm gonna do it. And that that was ultimately why.
Assemblyman, there is a Bible verse. I always think of it when I hear a politician switch parties or go to being an independent. It's Revelation 3:16. So because you are lukewarm, neither hot nor cold, I'm about to spit you out of my mouth. Are you worried at all that the political process will spit you out because you are not picking a side?
Well, as a pastor's son, that is quite the Bible verse to be able to use. I don't think I'm being lukewarm. The fight that I want to take on is to do away with the nonsense that has become our political system. And I don't think that is lukewarm at all.
So going forward then, what issues will you get behind in 2020?
We have some serious challenges here in California. While people have jobs, they're not making enough to be able to make ends meet. We have an affordability crisis. People can't afford to pay the rent. They can't afford to be able to buy a home. Our energy prices are higher than the rest of the country. So we have in California, from a public policy perspective, we have a tremendous amount of work left to do. And I'm looking forward to rolling up my sleeves when we get back in January and working with both Democrats and Republicans to confront those challenges head on.
And one more thing, Assemblyman, you mentioned earlier how when you made this switch that you made, people came up to you and said, you know, they were relieved because now that maybe they can make a similar kind of switch. Any advice you'd offer people still in the Republican Party or maybe even disillusioned Democrats who might feel like, look, I need to change something? What would you say to them?
I think if people are listening today, if you are currently a registered Democrat or if you're a registered Republican and you're tired of the two-party system and you're tired of this nasty dialogue that's happening in this country, go online to the Secretary of State, change your registration, go to No Party Preference as well. That is one very strong message that you can send to the leaders of both parties. Enough is enough. We're all Americans. We're all Californians. And we want you guys to work on solutions that benefit us and not benefit the parties.
That's California State Assemblyman Chad Mays. Thank you very much.
Thanks, A.
All right, moving on. Late last Friday, Pacific Gas and Electric announced it'll pay out $13.5 billion in claims to victims of recent disasters such as 2018's Camp Fire in Northern California. That's not enough for some people, though. A new poll out today by the LA Times says Californians are split about the future of the utility. About a third would be okay keeping the privately held company the way it is. Another third say they'd like to see PG&E become an entity run by the public. Now, that's similar to the effort being led by San Jose Mayor Sam Liccardo. His idea is to transform this company, privately run by shareholders, into a co-op owned by its customers. And just recently, he announced that more than 100 local elected officials from around the state are on board as well. Mayor Liccardo, welcome to Take Two.
Good to be with you, eh?
Now, you've been leading this effort for a few months now, but for those who have not been following this story, just basic question, why are you doing this?
Well, we'd like to transform PG&E from an investor-owned utility to a customer-owned utility, and really for two reasons. One is we want to better align the financial interests of the company with the customer's interest, the public's interest. And secondly, we really see a need over the next several years for a substantial investment around everything from basic maintenance to hardening the grid, to building microgrids, all the things that need to be done to restore safe and reliable service. Financial experts that we've been talking to are very convinced that a customer-owned utility will be able to get access to capital at a far lower cost. And because it will come at a much lower cost, it means more money can be reinvested in the infrastructure and in keeping rates down.
Okay, and we're going to get to all that coming up in just a bit. But PG&E is privately run, right now it is at least. What does privately run have to do with PG&E's responsibility when it comes to recent wildfires? Do you think, Mayor, that it has a contributing factor?
I think we all know that the company has failed badly in terms of protecting residents from wildfire risk. So the company's got a lot of work to do. The fact that it's investor-owned certainly creates problematic incentives. Now, I have nothing against investor-owned utilities in many contexts. I think they can work very well. But in the context where we've got a utility that has allowed its infrastructure to deteriorate as many years as it has, the investor-owned utility model simply doesn't work. In order to deliver better returns to its shareholders, the company essentially has to cut corners on maintenance and other basic responsibilities that would be needed to make the infrastructure safe. A customer-owned utility obviously would be beholden ultimately to the customer's interest, which is let's keep power reliable, safe, and affordable.
Now, officials like Governor Gavin Newsom have threatened a public takeover of the utility. How is your idea different, and what would be the number one advantage?
The challenge with a state takeover is, first, the state constitution prohibits the state from actually owning shares of stock in a company outside of its pension funds. Many of us who are local officials know that anytime you talk about a public takeover of private property, you now enter into the world of eminent domain. And that is very expensive, and it takes many years of litigation to get through. And at the end of it, usually taxpayers don't do well, and private property owners do very well. So I don't think a public takeover is the best path. And I don't think most residents want their power regulated or managed by politicians. But for an agency this size, I think it would be better as a private customer-owned utility. There are hundreds of utilities in this country that are customer-owned, and they can work well if they're well managed.
We're talking to San Jose Mayor Sam Liccardo. Now, the LA Department of Water and Power is owned and operated by the public. Just days ago, though, the federal government launched a lawsuit against the company alleging that its equipment sparked the 2017 Creek Fire. So right here in our own backyard, Mayor, a utility owned by the public, it doesn't seem to be a guarantee that it can prevent wildfires at 100% level. I mean, what do you think?
There's no guarantee with any model unless there is sufficient investment in the infrastructure to make it safe, as well as the maintenance. And in the case of PG&E, they weren't even clearing out the brush at a level that they had committed to the PUC. So the hope is that by having the right ownership and the right management, you'll align incentives in a way that dollars will get used to ensure safe and reliable service rather than simply paying off out-of-state hedge funds.
All right, so what's next for this effort?
We're going to continue to do our outreach, certainly in different geographic areas, as well as with key stakeholders, for example, in the environmental community and the equity community and elsewhere, to really hear what folks want in this transformation and to ensure that that we're hearing that and incorporating that into our model, into our principles. And we're going to continue to talk to the key institutions in the financial markets that can help make this happen. And hopefully, through additional dialogue with the governor's team and others, we're going to be able to find an open door to be able to present our plan.
That's the mayor of San Jose, Sam Liccardo. Mayor, thank you very much.
Thanks, A.
The Me Too movement has changed a lot of lives and careers, some for the better, but others for the worse. It all depends, if you can believe it, on the timing. We'll explain. Plus, another hashtag is having their Hollywood moment, one that might actually help folks actually afford to live in Hollywood. That's all coming up next when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Lots of news to get to all afternoon long here on KPCC. And the host of All Things Considered, Nick Roman, is here to tell us what's coming up later this afternoon.
Well, we have a whole lot. The University of California is looking at dropping standardized tests for admission. A new lawsuit might force them to move a little bit faster on that. California's salmon population has been dropping for decades, partly because climate change is warming the water. But there's a new UC Davis study out that has some hope for the future of salmon, and we'll have science reporter Jacob Margolis with us to explain. And you know that app TikTok, it's super yeah. popular. Security experts, though, have a warning about who's watching that app, and it traces back to China's Communist Party. So we're going to find out what Silicon Valley is doing about that. All of it comes up on All Things Considered at 4
Here's o'clock. Where I'm going to sound like. I'm going to sound like I'm a million years old. I know about it, and I'm terrified of it. I don't want to get on it because I'm afraid of what might happen.
Well, you and me both, because yeah. I'm panicked about all of those kind of things. It's amazing. My daughters are good at all this stuff. Me, not so much.
Unless the public demands a Nick Roman A. Martinez TikTok channel, if that exists.
Yeah, well, yeah, we can loop in Larry. Yeah. We do triple play.
There you go.
24 hours a day.
Nick Roman, all afternoon long here on 89.3 KPCC. Thanks, Nick.
Thanks, A.
All right, back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. A former Fox News anchor wants companies to drop their non-disclosure agreements. Plus, Verve is paying up. The talent agency announced it'll increase assistant salaries by 25% to 40%, up to $20 an hour. Let's go on the lot.
God is my witness.
Stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Rebecca Keegan is our guide as usual. She's with The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello, A.
All right, the film Bombshell about the women who brought down Fox News CEO Roger Ailes opens this week.
You're a man-hater. Learn to get along with the boys. You're sexy, but you're too much work. I have a whole list.
Will other women come forward?
That's Nicole Kidman as Fox alum Gretchen Carlson. Remind us of what happened to Carlson at Fox 3 years ago.
Gretchen Carlson is in many ways the person who kicked off the Me Too movement. Before the Harvey Weinstein stories broke, Carlson brought a sexual harassment suit against Roger Ailes and Fox News and ultimately ended up settling for $20 million and inspiring a lot of other women at that network to come forward.
Yeah, and you followed up on some of these women. Where are they now 3 years later, and what's their experience been?
Well, it's interesting. It was after seeing Bombshell that I got to thinking, what happened to all of these women? Mm. And so I started calling some of the women who are portrayed as, you know, minor characters in the film. And I was really surprised to see that almost none of them are working in TV news any longer. Some of them have gone back to careers they had before that, in law or in political consulting. And the women described to me over and over again having meetings with agents or executives at networks. They were considered toxic because of the suit that they had brought at Fox.
Not employable. Wow. Because of the suit. Not their performance necessarily, just not employable because of what happened.
Right. And as one woman told me, you know, an agent told her, why? I represent women who work at Fox now. If I take you on as a client, it's going to hurt my other clients who are at Fox.
Now, it's worth noting that these women brought attention to the harassment they were experiencing before the hashtag MeToo movement began in earnest, in some cases just right before. How did the timing, Rebecca, make a difference for them in their careers?
Well, it's interesting. As you say, these suits were brought, many of them, before the Harvey Weinstein stories broke in October. The stories at Fox News started earlier than that. Some of these women much earlier than that. There's one woman in my story named Rudy Bakhtiar who brought her complaint to HR a decade ago. And what's interesting is that whether the women brought their suits a decade ago or more recently, they did not find any more hospitable of a climate when they tried to get hired. Mm. The women who came out and spoke more recently did get a lot of sort of public pats on the back, a lot of people expressing solidarity, but that didn't translate into job opportunities.
Now, related to all this, Carlson and some of her former Fox colleagues are starting a new initiative called Lift Our Voices. Rebecca, what's that about?
Right. So Gretchen Carlson and some of her former Fox News colleagues are interested in the issue of non-disclosure agreements, and they are trying to convince companies to drop the parts of their non-disclosure agreements that cover sexual harassment, discrimination. They understand the role of NDAs in terms of protecting company secrets. They're, of course, widely used here in Hollywood, but they don't want them to be used to cover up bad workplace behavior.
And Carlson herself said her own personal experience was very lonely and isolating through all this, but NDAs are kind of sort of the status quo, as you mentioned, in Hollywood. How are Carlson and former Fox alum Julie Rogniski hoping to get companies to just eradicate them, to just get them out of the way?
Well, there's already been a legislative move to address NDAs. There are a number of states that have, since the Me Too movement begun, passed laws that will prohibit companies from being able to use them to cover up harassment and discrimination. California is one of those states. Roginsky and Carlson would like companies to take that a step further. They would like the way NDAs can be abused to be understood all across the country. They would also, by the way, like to be released from their own specific NDAs with Fox News. Each of those women has asked Fox News to be released from her NDA. I called Fox. They declined to comment on whether they'll do that.
Yeah, it's one thing, I guess, Rebecca, to protect a company secret, maybe a creative secret. But when you're covering up a crime or protecting a crime, that's a different story.
Right. And in the entertainment industry, people use NDAs all the time to, say, keep a script private or to not reveal, say, a costume of a character. The problem is they're written so broadly that they can be applied to other kinds of things.
All right, let's move on now to another sector of Hollywood that's having trouble, and that's assistants. First, briefly recap the hashtag Pay Up Hollywood movement.
Pay Up Hollywood started as a conversation about assistant horror stories on the Script Notes podcast. And then it became a hashtag. Now it's evolved to become really kind of a full-fledged movement, which advocates for livable wages and improved work conditions for industry assistants.
All right, but now one agency has responded that they're moving toward a change. What's going on, Rebecca?
Right, the Verve agency, which represents some people who have been at the forefront of the Pay Up Hollywood movement, took some formal steps this week to show that they are changing in response. First of all, they've offered raises, sizable ones, to people, including their mailroom assistants, who were making $14.25 an hour. They'll now make $17.50 an hour. Other assistant-level positions at the agency are going up as well by as much as 40%.
Enough, though, to live in L.A.?
I mean, it's never enough to live in L.A., as we all know. But most of the people who are assistants in Hollywood, according to a survey that Pay Up Hollywood did, are actually relying on family members for financial support because the wages have been so low. And of course, if that's necessary to do the job, that rules out a whole lot of people who aren't lucky enough to have families that can help them.
You think this is just the beginning of a larger movement? Maybe expect more growth in wages and more companies jumping on to the Pay Up Hollywood train.
You know, as someone who's covered Hollywood for about 15 years, I'm fascinated by this movement because for so long, the industry's liberal politics have not extended to practices at their own companies and to their own colleagues. That seems to be changing, at least at Verve, which should give it a hiring advantage versus the other agencies, which are bigger and better known. We'll see if this spreads to other agencies and other workplaces in Hollywood.
All right, Rebecca. Now, before I let you go, I had to bring up the new Wonder Woman 1984 trailer.
My life hasn't been what you probably think it has. We all have our struggles.
Have you ever been in love?
A long, long time ago. You?
So many times. Yeah. All the time.
Rebecca, have you seen it? What do you think?
As you know, I'm a completely impartial journalist who would never get all rah-rah about a trailer, but I will say this movie is set in 1984, and in addition to the usual action you'd expect from a superhero trailer, there's a lot of cool period details, including Chris Pine wearing a fanny pack. What's not to love about that? So I was down. I'm curious your reaction as the sort of superhero expert of the two of us.
Well, Rebecca, Wonder Woman is using her lasso to actually ride lightning in the trailer. So, I mean, right there, that's enough for me. But it's a big deal, right? Patty Jenkins, it's making her second Wonder Woman movie. So a lot's riding on this.
Yeah, the first movie was an outsized hit. They've got a lot of the same creative people involved. Patty Jenkins, the director, is back, as you say. And I think, you know, our conversation about this exemplifies why this movie is apt to be a hit. You get your lightning riding, I get my funny fanny pack. There's kind of something for everybody.
And Kristen Wiig's in it.
And Kristen Wiig.
People saw the trailer, they might be wondering, well, what's she doing? She's actually a villain. So it sounds like to me that they're kind of relying on her comedic chops to a villain character to keep everything fun, but also give her a chance to kind of maybe expand her repertoire a bit.
Yeah, leaning into the humor in this one, which I am all for.
Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. She joins us every week to talk about all things showbiz. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, a list just came out of the 101 best restaurants in LA. I know. How does someone even make those choices?
I think we're looking for restaurants that have a lot of creative agency, but also creative urgency.
The rankings that will sure to thrill and upset Angelenos all at the same time. That's next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. Amy Martinez. Last night, the LA Times dropped their 101 Best Restaurants list. 2019 marks year six of the much-anticipated roundup, which was started by beloved food critic Jonathan Gold. His legacy continues with added twists provided by the editors of this year's list, critics Bill Addison and Patricia Escarzaga. Welcome to you both.
Hi.
Hi.
All right, Bill, Patricia, I mean, you guys have had almost a year to get this thing in motion. You've really dove in on this. Patricia, let's start with you. What was this experience like for you two?
I think the word I would use to describe this past year is surreal. A few years ago, my husband and I, we did a whole Los Angeles food vacation, and it was centered around the 2014 edition of the 101 list. So you can imagine, as someone who's been following the list very closely for the last several years, imagine if someone handed it to you and was like, here, you go ahead and put it together now. So that's been kind of my experience. I feel incredibly privileged and just incredibly thrilled to work on it.
Bill, how was it co-piloting the list for you? Because, yeah, Patricia's right. As much as people want to see the list, they also want to know what went into it and what went into your choices. So tell us, what was it like co-piloting this thing?
I was Eater's national critic for 5 years before starting as one of the critics at the Times in December, last December. So I have spent a big part of what I did at Eater was spend the year researching what the publication called the National 38, the Eater 38. So now come back to being a city critic as I was before in Atlanta and San Francisco and Dallas. Los Angeles feels like a country in and of itself. So in some ways, working on this project felt very familiar to me. I felt very prepared after my years at Eater. And yet the city constantly evolves and surprises and changes. And there are layers and layers of cultures on top of one another here. And it just felt amazing to stay in one place and yet go everywhere around the globe to eat.
Yeah, Bill, and you nailed it, right? It is a country to itself. And given the size of our region and the variety of cuisines, how do you even begin to cull the list? Give us some of your criteria, Bill. Let's start with you.
We started by honoring what our colleagues, Jen Harris, Andrea Cheng, and Amy Scattergood had done with the list. They didn't rank it last year. They called it 101 Restaurants We Love. We looked at Jonathan Gold's last list from 2017, and we ate everywhere on those lists. And then we kind of branched out and followed our noses and our palates. And of course, the amazing communities known for the restaurant cultures here, Koreatown, the SGV, Boyle Heights, which is incredible for Mexican food, of course. And then you just fill in the gaps. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're starting over already.
Patricia, Bill mentioned how you guys ranked it this year, wasn't ranked last year. Why'd you guys decide to go one through 101?
For us, it really helped just instill some kind of order into this huge project. And I think it's a great way to engage with our readers, you know, get a conversation started, and also kind of pinpoint, you know, where is the culinary pulse of Los Angeles right now?
All right, so let's get to the cream of the crop. The best restaurant this year was, maybe for some, a bit of an upset. Top spot went to a Taiwanese restaurant in Sawtelle, Cato. Bill, you did the write-up, but tell us about the dishes that won you over and the owner of the place.
John Yao is a 28-year-old native of Walnut in the San Gabriel Valley. His parents came to this country and settled. They had initially taken this small spot in a West LA strip mall to use as a catering kitchen. And their young son took it over and started composing these tasting menus in a small 28-seat dining room. And in 3 years, Yao really found an exceptional voice. He is channeling his Taiwanese heritage into the dishes he creates, honoring them, rethinking them, representing them. He'll reimagine the very beloved Taiwanese beef noodle soup, deconstructed so that there's this very fragrant broth over a beautifully seared piece of beef. Or boba tea, which is very beloved in Taiwan, gets reimagined into a dessert of like sweet potato spheres with these golden sable cookies shaved over them that melt every time you put one in your mouth. It's just extraordinary food. And it represents the very best of LA, the ambition, the imagination, the creative urgency.
We're talking to LA Times food critics Patricia Scarziga and Bill Addison, telling us about their 101 best restaurant list for 2019. Now, Bill and Patricia, I don't know if you two have had time yet to sift through all of the emails and tweets that say, how dare you put this place here or not include this one in the list at all. So, but I want to ask specifically about one restaurant that in years past was a favorite of Jonathan Gold, and that's Vespertine, a new American fine dining spot in Culver City. Had a bit of a fall from grace, barely made it on your list this year. What happened with them?
If you read the write-up he did for it, he really is very honest about his experience and relationship to the restaurant. And I don't want it to seem like it's just sort of hanging there at the end of the list. I like to think of it more as a bookend. We have Cato on one end.
What
we
a
have
politician, Patricia, you are. My goodness.
It really does help to look at it. They're both fine dining, but they're so incredibly different.
I mean, it's on the list because it's a talker, right?
Hey, you two guys decided to number them. You didn't have to number them.
Right. It can be seen as a very snarky comment that in 2017 it was number one and now it's number 101. I have very mixed feelings about this restaurant. I've had one experience that I really loved with colleagues and two others not with colleagues that I really loathed. So if you want to go spend $295 per person for beverages, et cetera, sure. See what you think.
Now, you both seem to have one of the best jobs to have in all of Los Angeles. I can imagine, though, that it's a tall order to be the final word on all of this. So for you both, Patricia, let's start with you. What do you think defines a prime dining experience in Los Angeles 2019-2020?
I think we're looking for restaurants that have a lot of creative agency, but also creative urgency. Restaurants that feel like they're on the precipice of something, like they have questions that aren't quite answered. They're interesting restaurants. They're restaurants that represent the city's diversity and restaurants that, you know, represent a lot of that barrier of entry that we have here in Los Angeles, where hopefully the idea that anybody can move into a strip mall and do something remarkable. I hope that idea never dies here.
Bill, what about you? Prime dining experience in LA now. What does that look like?
It feels like nothing that's quite come before it. It sort of circumnavigates the notions of authenticity and elevation. It can be someone who is channeling their Mexican or Singaporean or Lebanese heritage into something that their family in part might recognize and in part might not recognize. This is the most exciting city for eating in America because the diners are open-minded, the chefs are like creatively energized, and we don't know what's next because it springs from the mind of fresh chefs who are given permission to do something new.
And that's what makes it awesome. That's LA Times food critics Patricia Skarsgård and Bill Addison telling us about their 101 best restaurant list for 2019. Bill, Patricia, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, one more thing on the way out.
Se prepara el lanzamiento, viene, batazo profundo al jardín central, la pelota se va, y despídala con un beso.
That is the signature home run call of Dodgers Hall of Fame broadcaster, San Marino resident, and Ecuadoriano Jaime Jarrín. He turns 84 years old today. For over six decades, he's been an icon to millions of Spanish speakers all over L.A., a hero to me growing up as a baseball fan in an Ecuadorian household. So on his birthday, feliz cumpleaños, paisano, tu ciudad te ama mucho.